How much is it to Tesla swap a Honda?
The cost-effective way to do it is to definitely use battery modules, right? You pay per kilowatt hour. So you have to, if you're trying to save money, you're going to get a small battery pack, right? And then you're going to use a used motor, and the motors that are quote unquote like hackable, or, you know, you can take out the inverter logic board and put a Cascadia / AEM one in it, is going to be the Tesla Model S stuff. So you use a Tesla Model S. Those motors are like $1,000 to $4,000, just depending on where you source it and which one you use. And then batteries, like I said, you pay per kilowatt hour. So a really small battery pack that's like 16 kilowatts, like my EG, is probably about $2,500. This is all used. And then a big battery pack like my EK, 85 kilowatts, $16,000 to $20,000 used. If you wanted to build my EG, which is a single motor, front motor only, very small battery pack, you'd probably be 25 to 30. And then my EK is a dual motor, so it's all-wheel drive, 300 horsepower per motor. That's probably like a $60,000 deal.
Ryan Basseri of RyeWire Motorsports. Eat, Sleep, Race podcast. We're here at the PRI trade show in Indianapolis and very happy to run into our friend, Ryan Basseri of RyeWire Motorsports. Is it RyeWire Motorsports?
RyeWire Motorsport Electronics. That's what I call it now.
All right. Yeah. And co-host Frankie Five, ESR. And let's get the ball rolling here.
Sure.
You have been a expert at wiring for over two decades now. Started off on the Honda platform, right?
Yeah, I was just really intrigued with Hondas. They were fun to modify. My uncle actually got me really into it, like into CRXs specifically. So I just started building CRXs, doing swaps, and then that led me to trying to figure out the wiring harness, which seemed like nobody understood, and I decided to tackle it.
That's like me today. Like, when I look at a wiring harness, it's like, I don't even know. It's a crazy puzzle to me. So for guys like you who are able to decipher wiring.
Right.
I'm curious, are you formally trained?
No, I'm not. Really what it was just kind of looking at wiring harnesses, dissecting them, and then kind of figuring out where stuff went. I actually didn't even really know that ETMs or electronic troubleshooting manuals were even a thing or even available when I first started. And honestly, I didn't even know how to wire a relay when I did my first wiring harness. Because I literally feel like I learned everything backwards. It was the backwards engineering and dissecting that led me to have the confidence to make kind of my first what I needed to get done. And I think the first thing I ever made was a VTEC sub-harness for an OBD0 CRX. It was like adding four wires. You add VTEC, VTEC oil, secondary O2, and a NOx sensor. And that was kind of where I got my feet wet. And I discovered something that was really interesting, that the Japanese cars and the US cars, they actually have two positions for O2 sensor, but their connectors are flip-flopped. Anyway, so I discovered that and the car actually ran right. And that's what really like made me realize, wow, I could probably tackle this and it could be something. And at least I should do this more, because I was able to discover something that kind of was not known online. Like OBD0 CRXs with a PR3, I know this is like overload of like numbers, but never run right because they just don't. And I actually discovered by putting the oxygen sensors on the right runners and flipping the plugs around and actually looking at what it was and how it was wired in the Japanese cars, I was able to actually get the car to run just the same as an SIR. And that was really early on. This is like in 99 or something like that. And that was pretty cool discovery. And then that kind of led me onto this path.
I think a common trait with a lot of people in wiring, you guys are problem solvers.
Right. You have to be. Yeah.
Do you like puzzles?
I hate puzzles.
I would not have figured
hate
that.
Puzzles.
Because it's kind of the same, right? It's like initially with anything wrong with the car, like, man, it's probably the wiring. Well, there's 100 wires here. Like, where do you even start? For me, but for you, I bet you're like, I know where to start. It's here.
You would think so. I actually get super nervous, and like I find my hands moving a lot, And like, I get all this anxiety when I like can't figure something out. Just the same as somebody normally would if when they're like frustrated by something. So it's not like I'm not like super calm when it comes to complex problem solving.
I would not have figured that.
I know it's weird and it's just me, but I just realized that it's something that was possible and I wanted more discovery. And I just decided to go deeper and deeper and deeper, probably because I had no other real thing that like excited me much when it came to building cars. I mean, you can turn wrenches, but like everybody does. But I just found this path where it was like everybody's too scared to go in this direction. Nobody really does it. So then that's why I kind of just decided to like spearhead it. But it was an organic and slow process. So it wasn't just like, oh, I'm going to jump into this massive, you know, undertaking. It was organic, slow, and eventually made sense over time.
So the CRX, how many years ago was that, like your first dip into wiring versus you legally registered your company 19, 20 years ago?
Right.
How long was it a hobby before it became a profession?
Yeah, yeah. Probably a good 6, 7, 8, something like that, years. So, you know, in high school, I started really getting into Hondas. I remember there was a time over summer break. I don't remember if it was like sophomore or whatever year, but my little tight group of friends, we all went different places for the summer. And like, I stayed at home, but like those two other guys like went somewhere else. And we all came back with the same Turbo magazine. You know, Turbo magazine, yeah, yeah. Right? There's a red EG on the cover. And it had little like air scoop, like little retrofitted bump where the air intake for the turbo was. And it had like a little mesh screen, I remember, on it. And we all had the same magazine. And we're like, dude, yes, we're building Hondas. This is rad. So we all got into it kind of. So my buddy Josh, he went to Minnesota and he came back because his buddy was street racing, or all his friends over there were street racers. So then he came back with like, dude, there's Hondas are so cool. And then like I organically got into it. My uncle got me into it a bit. And then my other buddy, like we all came, like we were hooked.
So who was your first customer?
My first customer was probably a client on like eBay, because I was selling, I had success with converting and putting the VTEC sub harness. So I was selling the VTEC sub harnesses on eBay. And then my next real client was, I made you familiar with the dual point CRXs, right? Those are the ones that would like two fuel injectors. Uh-oh. And they're the difficult conversions. You have to go from a DPFI to MPFI. And then now everybody's going OBD1 and et cetera, et cetera. Right. And that was like, you know, well, that was like 20 years ago, but still, it was this kind of progress where you had to take the base model car and then you'd make it into the SI, the more premium version, right? So I had a friend, her name was Jade, and she had a CRX, and she really wanted to convert her car to OBD1, and then she also wanted to convert it to MPFI because it was a DX. So I made up this little, like, I was just trying to save time. She was the one that was really doing the swap, and I was just trying to save us time by creating some kind of a wiring harness so we didn't have to spend, like, 3 days on it. It could be maybe a day and a half job instead of like a 3 day long job. So I made this harness, brought it up to her place, and we installed it. And that's what really made me think like, oh, okay, this could be a product now, because I could make these wiring harnesses and then modify them and ship them back out. So at first, for years, we were just doing like, send me your harness, I'll tear it down, I'll rework it, and I'll send it back to you. It wasn't even brand new products at that point.
Oh, so you were reusing, because I was going to say, like, how did you know, like, what gauge to use?
Right.
Copper versus, like, what metal, what type of wiring we're going to use?
Right.
How did you figure that out?
Yeah, early on, all I was doing was just copying what was originally there. Adding things, rerouting things. I would go, okay, this wire is this size. Okay, I would get donor wire, and I would, like, use the same size wire. And I didn't really know. I mean, early on, we're talking, like, you know, shoot, it was a long time ago. 2003, 2004, like in that range. Yeah, I didn't really know what I was doing, but eventually I got a knack of it. And I was like, wow, this all of a sudden clicked. I know how to like energize a relay. I know why I need it. I know how to like use smaller wires to activate the relay with bigger wires, current draws, and da 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 da. I just started like learning that organically because I needed to. You know, it's like you, you wire a fuel pump wrong one time and you're going to learn really quick how to do it right the next time.
So what did you use to help you learn and understand that you needed to do those things?
Just a lot of it was, well, sometimes if it was aftermarket, they would come with a wiring diagram.
Yeah.
And I would sort out what's going on and I'd understand it. Otherwise, I would just backwards engineer the factory stuff.
Started out with Hondas 20 years later. What percentage of your business is still Hondas?
I'd say it's probably a good like 60% still.
And then what's the next manufacturer?
The next is Mazda.
Oh, wow.
We do a lot of rotary harnesses. And then we have a bunch of private label stuff. And that private label is, you know, little bits of everything. A lot of it's electric vehicle stuff. A lot of it is like, you know, BMWs and stuff that you wouldn't even associate me with doing, but I make something for another company. And sometimes we'll cross brand it. Like I do a Supra harness for Rad Dan, Rad Industries, like Formula Drift Driver. And that's like a collaborative, both of our names are on that product. But I designed that with him. And then now that's, you know, it's private label because I don't sell it on my website.
So for those who don't know what private label, white label is, that's when Ryan manufactures, creates a harness, sells it to another company. They put their brand on it. They don't really know that Ryan was the one who made it. And then they sell it.
Yeah. Yeah. And as long as the quality is good, then everybody's happy.
Yeah.
And as long as we're getting paid for what we're doing, then cool. You know, I don't mind. It's not like I don't have too much pride or anything like that. So
is RyeWire a one-man show?
No, we always kind of fluctuate how many people are, you know, in the team, but it's normally about four of us.
So do you have your hands on every kit still, or?
No, we have a manufacturing place that we use in Los Angeles, California, and they're very close to my shop, and I've been working with them for probably a good, like, definitely over 10, closer to 15 years. So we're really dialed with them. We can present them a product that we develop in house. And if we know that, you know, we're going to order 100 of these or something like that, if it's going to be a hot seller, I can't staff that many people. Land is expensive in California too.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to like, you know, I don't want to oversee like all these people, like in a, I don't know, sweatshop environment is how I kind of picture it. And I'm like, I don't want to be a part of that. So, we work with a group that does really nice stuff. And they'll just do it. They'll try as many times as possible until it's exactly how I want it. And then they'll just do the run. So, you know, we design everything. We just don't put our hands on every single loom. A lot of prototype, a lot of bespoke stuff, like all that we're touching.
Do you prefer when, especially for bespoke, do you need the car in hand?
It's a lot easier. It could save us time. But it could also waste a lot more time because if you have to like tear down old stuff, put your stuff on, mock it up, put the old stuff back on, if it's not like, you know, where it needs to be or whatever, it might not permanently live on the car. I don't know. That could take a lot more time. I do like the way we do it. Typically, it's just like, hey, measure this out. Okay, let me get my own engine and let me do my own fitment. Just give me like key things. As long as whoever I'm working with is down to put in a bit of time and, you know, work through it. It doesn't necessarily have to be on the vehicle. You don't have to have the car there.
Okay. So going back to the Hondas, D series, B series, then it went to K series. What is the future for Honda swaps?
Well, from what we're seeing, the L series looks like it could be a pretty good candidate. And that's the, we can call it the L15 B7. You're talking like 2017 Civic Si. It's a turbocharged engine, so turbocharged has a lot of potential. It's really inexpensive, but probably, you know, it's going to cost a good amount of money to put into a car.
So how much is the motor at a junkyard versus the install?
Engine's probably like $1,000, and then install, I don't know, like parts could be another $10,000.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, for sure. Cause like we're talking that our engine harness is probably going to be like $1,600-1,700. And then you need mount kits. Those are always going to be, mount kits are always going to be like, you know, $600 to $800 at least. And then you need to do custom fuel systems still. There's a, you know, you might not get a computer or something like that with your setup. And I know that, Hondata and K-Tuner and a few companies are working on solutions with OEM based computers. But if you like don't get one of the parts with your conversion, then you're going to always be paying more. There's a lot of small details, just like when you're doing a case swap, stuff adds up. But as we know, over time, the more products that become available, the more competition, the price ends up, you know, and then unfortunately going down probably pretty drastically once Chinese parts and stuff take over. So
what car, what chassis are you seeing that that motor viable in?
All your Golden Era stuff.
Okay.
CRXs, EGs, DC2s, EKs, even like possibly like some RSXs or, you know, I mean, the sky's the limit. You know, you think, oh, you got a K-Series, why would you take it out? Yeah. Well, these engines do make a little bit more power. It just depends on your goal, you know? There's people that take NSX engines out of NSXs and put K20s in.
Right.
And maybe they'll do K20Cs, or they'll do, those are just more money, or they'll do the mini version, which is the L15B7. So we'll see. I mean, putting a 1.5 liter in an NSX with a turbo seems super weird, but that's what we thought when we saw K20s in them too.
How many do you know of cars running complete L-series swaps?
Currently? Yeah, there's some, yeah. There's probably 7 to 10 that I'm slightly aware of, like that I'm more or less aware of.
Are they for the street or are they race cars?
There's not any like that I've seen like serious drag cars yet, just because those engines haven't been fully developed. You got to think about it like you're going to be developing new pistons, new rods, new like camshafts, like all that development has to be kind of back to the drawing board. You know, there's not a whole lot of overlap parts. So nothing really with drag cars, but circuit cars, totally. A lot of them are circuit race, and then there's a lot of street cars. But there's also like L series. I think that there might be like a racing series that are starting to maybe implement those engines in like a non-EGD. It's like, it's a different, it's like a race car.
What was your first Honda, and what was the setup on it?
First Honda was a CRX B16 swap, and like the next 7 cars after that were all CRXs and various.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. Turbo single cams, a couple of them. I tried like right-hand drive conversions, did GSR swap, K20R swap.
These all turned into R&D vehicles for all your harnesses that you currently have available, it seems like.
Pretty much, yeah. Like so, the first K-swap harness that we ever did was from on my CRX. And I told myself I would never do it again. Can you believe that?
Why is that?
It was just challenging and there was a lot to it. And it took like a couple days to make one harness.
But now you have a standard kit.
Yeah, now they're just like hundreds of them are on the shelf ready to go. So,
this question is going to get into another topic. You moved into a new shop that looks like a museum per se, like a modern museum, just because it looks just like your house. It's next level.
I really appreciate architecture.
There you go.
And it's something that kind of intrigues me, especially living in Southern California. We have all these like mid-century modern architects that are really cool. You know, there's something about it. I just love glass cornered windows that are cantilevered. Like if you got a cantilever in a glass corner, it's just so sick looking. Or like a clear story window where the windows are really high, you know? I just think that just introducing light into spaces that are normally dark, it just feels really good. And if you've lived in a home like that, my grandmother, when I was a kid, had a custom mid-century modern home in Monterey right on top of the hill.
Oh, wow.
So sick. Sickest house ever. Just everything that you would want in a mid-mod house, she had it. It was so rad, like living and being in that space. And then my dad had this old Victorian home and he basically did a full add-on and just did all like, it just looked like mid-mod, like floor to ceiling glass and like all these like light introduction, you know, it was really cool. So I was introduced to that growing up and living in Cali, like probably 50% of the people were living in homes like that because it was so popular, you know, in the 50s, 60s, 70s to have that kind of flow and free flowing and outside inside feel. So with the shop, it was the same thing. Like my house, I remodeled it really cool. You know, I'm not going to lie. Like I love living there. It's awesome.
Yeah. Like your garage goes from the front to the backyard and then you can even park the cart literally in the house.
Yeah.
Definitely check out his Instagram page. He definitely, a few people have posted, like you did. I think you invited some people over and they were taking pictures.
I had
the
some
garage
parties.
Is insane at what he said. So
make
sure you're on Instagram following Ryan and looking at his house and definitely translated that into your shop now with the corner, the glass corner edges. So, I saw that. You know?
So you know what I realized? Like if you have a design style and you have like a vision, and then you could put it on some kind of like a CAD drawing for your architect, and your architect could create that into something that's actually like
viable.
Yeah, exactly. Buildable, viable. Then it's not, it doesn't cost that much more to build in that style.
Mm.
You know what I mean? There's always going to be like the premium quality windows, the things that you're just spending just arm and a leg for almost for nothing. You know what I mean? Or it's arguable, right? But then at the same time, it's like you could spend a little bit more money and you can get a lot more for your money if you really know what you're doing. Like I was literally with the builder, like, okay, we're going to notch this piece of this slab here, and then we're going to recess this glass wall. So there's no, I don't want any threshold. I want it to be completely flat. And it was like, I had to like pull his leg to do that, but he ended up doing it, and it's complete flush transition now. You know what I mean? Like little things like that. Like you can do it, man. Just do it.
I like that.
It's not that it's harder. You just have to actually do it. Don't take the path of least resistance. No pun intended. Just do it this way. It'll be 10% harder, and then the outcome of it will be 100% better.
Were you an artist when you were a kid? Like,
not really. Not really.
Because it shows in the quality of the work of your builds, your personal builds, and clearly seen in the architecture of your homes and obviously in your new office. I would have thought there's some sort of like artist in the background of all this.
Not really, but I think I've grown into that a bit, where it's something that I've organically now kind of gone, yeah, I guess I am an artist when it comes to engine bays and it comes to, you know, my house and stuff like that. I've just kind of became an artist, I guess, in some way.
Clearly.
Thanks.
Enough that your houses could end up in some architecture magazines. If they're not already, they probably are.
No.
Let's go back to Hondas.
We always have to circle back to Hondas.
Go back to the Hondas.
So. Don't worry, guys. If you're watching this, we go beyond Hondas.
So,
but then we'll end up at Hondas inevitably.
Back
for sure.
To the Hondas. You know, we bump in, you know, you're from Cali, we're from Jersey. We mm-hmm. bump into you. Bump into you. I think we saw you at Tokyo Auto Salon when we went there. We bumped into you. We bumped into you in a lot of places.
Sure.
Car guys.
Yeah. Because we're car guys. Since you go around a lot and you are this Honda enthusiast and you've seen...
Connoisseur.
Have you seen the West Coast? You've seen the East Coast? You've seen international? From a Honda perspective, let's talk about the East Coast and the West Coast. In terms of the culture... Mm-hmm. Right, the West Coast Honda culture versus the East Coast. Is it the same? Is it different? What do you see that the West Coast may have more of versus what the East Coast or vice versa? What are your thoughts around like what you're seeing?
So we're talking East Coast, West Coast Honda scene.
Yeah, I would say West Coast, I think, has overall maybe a little bit cleaner builds, but obviously East Coast is way faster. So way more drag focused on the East Coast. And I think that's like the roots, you know, the roots is drag racing. And I think that typical LA, everybody wants to just like,
but Honda drag racing started more on the West Coast. So it's kind of drastic how it switched.
We're going to have these people are going to be commenting.
You guys have more tracks.
Yeah,
that's true. But I guess like you do have a point, and we've been to the West Coast, we've been to Ibachni, we've seen all these shows.
Yeah.
You know, the biggest thing that you guys have versus the East Coast is the weather. You have the weather.
Yes.
You have flat roads. We have brutal winters.
Terrible roads.
We have salt on the roads. We have bumpy roads.
Can't drive your cars.
You can't make a left turn. Yeah. You got to make a U-turn.
Yep.
Right? So like that, you could just tell by like the cold, like how the states, you know. The East Coast is truly different, and you know that's one thing that sometimes when I was growing up, I was like, I'd love to be on the West Coast because I felt like that was just a good vibe.
Yeah,
to build a car.
You know, I don't have much experience with this, but Washington has a bit of weather, and they probably have better builds than Cali, I think.
Really?
Yeah. So I mean, that's kind of something. There is that, but the weather's not nearly as harsh as New York, New York. I brought my GT3 to New York City and we did like a drive in Pitt and Paddock.
Yeah.
And that car got thrashed on those roads. So nah, I'm not driving any Hondas over there.
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. Where in the world has the best quality Honda built?
Best quality Honda builds. I mean,
I've got a country in mind.
Yeah?
Will you agree? Thailand.
Thailand's pretty good. I've been to Thailand, but I haven't been to the Honda scene there. I've been invited, so hopefully I get to go soon.
Oh, so in your experience,
yeah.
where have you seen?
Indonesia's pretty good. I go to Indonesia
every year.
I go often. Like, I'm there. I've probably gone four times now. Did the IMX show over there. I'm one of the judges. And they got really, really good Honda builds.
You know what's funny? We're mentioning U.S., Thailand, Indonesia. No one mentioned Japan.
True. They're good in Japan, too, though. They are very good. But different style. Dude, wait. And actually, the style varies a lot. When you're talking Tokyo area, and then like north of Tokyo, and then, you know, you got Osaka, a bit more south.
I feel the trendsetters are in Japan, but for some reason, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Thailand put it on steroids.
Yeah.
Like, there might be more spoon sports builds in Thailand than there are in any other country.
100%. I don't know how. I mean, they either just have like the money to do it, and they don't care about the prices, or maybe some, I mean, I don't know, but some of it could be some knockoff or some custom stuff. But I think that a lot of those builds are real deal parts.
Yeah, no, I definitely think so.
Like in Indo, there was a couple like full spoon, full Mugen, like EGDC Golden Era stuff, and I was kind of blown away. Like, how
more
you
than you'll see in California.
More than Cali, yeah.
So is Rywire international?
Meaning
you have a lot of customers.
You have
overseas?
Customers in like Indonesia.
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah, we have customers all over the world. We're shipping all over the world. You know, like every day, every other day, whatever. But yeah, like we have distribution through Turn 14.
Okay.
And Turn 14 is, I mean, it's a U.S. company, and it's, you know, one day shipping to anywhere in the United States. But they have a lot of clients that are overseas as well. So organically, our products get circulated all over the world. So I get to enjoy it and see it. And sometimes it sneaks up on me. You know, somebody goes, let me show you, please come. And I'm like, hey, I've seen an EG before, bro. And like, oh, he's showing me all my products. Cool, you know?
Yeah.
So that feels good.
There's awesome. Many options now when it comes to companies that specialize in wiring.
Sure.
Why Rywire?
OG, man. We've been doing it since they were babies. I guess I could say I actually, but I think that there's nobody that knows that knows wiring as good as me. Like, I've been doing it for so long, and I've had so many. I mean, there's I don't think that there's anybody in this quote unquote wiring industry that has sold the amount of distribution of products that I have. Like, I've sold a lot of wiring.
Are you going to take the claim to be the king of wiring?
No, I wouldn't. I'm actually really modest about that kind of stuff. I don't ever say that I'm the best at anything. I don't ever say any of that. I let people...
But you will say no one can do it better than you.
I don't think that anybody could, because they just don't have the experience. And I've been doing it for so long, every single day, for as long as I have. I just don't know how it would be even possible to sell as many and have as many clients in the wiring industry as we have.
So. Because you're modest, that does translate to the king of wiring.
Okay,
so
all right.
Just
fair
letting
enough.
You know.
Fair enough. I, you know, brush my shoulders off here. Yeah.
We spoke about Hondas for a long time here. Let's get into your personal collection, which I know is not all Hondas, but I think a majority of your collection is inside of your new shop. I saw quite a few lifts in there.
Yeah.
What's your current stable?
It consists of, I had three 911s, and one of them was like a long-term build that just didn't really work out, so I'm down to two. I have a 993 and a 997. 997 is GT3 RS. 993 is just a Carrera. Yeah, it's really cool. It's got a bunch of like RS bits on it and stuff. Pretty cool build. And then a bunch of Hondas. Yeah.
So because your stable is Hondas and Porsches, but Hondas is 60%, do you see potential for your business to grow in the Porsche market?
I see potential there, yeah. I don't know why, but I've kind of kept a lot of that just bespoke, meaning like just to the really high-end clients, and I do very custom-tailored because I feel like that they want custom-tailored. But I've started to realize that maybe there's a market for, like, you know...
Standard?
Yeah, more standard. Because now I feel like before, the bespoke ones was, like, kind of trying to pull teeth to do this certain engine package that I like, the one that's on Ravi's 911, his air cooled. That is like the best engine package that I could dream up. That's the Kinsler ITBs with the dual drive-by-wire. It's got a MoTeC on it. It uses our little baby P14 PDM to control all the injectors and coil packs and everything. So it's fully programmable. My buddy Bo does all the he used to do all the Singer programming and tuning. And I was like, we got to have Bo to tune this car, right? Bo was like, oh my God, you did the dream setup. You did the setup that I've been wanting Singer to do this whole time. That's the dual servo motors. He's like, we can make this car drive so good with this setup. And I was like, cool, let's do it. You know, and we tuned it. And he was just like, when the throttle response was unreal. He's like, dude, I've never driven a Porsche like this before. But now.
And you credit that mostly to the wiring?
To the whole package, the decision to do all the different components with those different sensors.
Because it's top of the line, everything.
Yeah, with the MoTeC M1 ECU, all that stuff was, I just wanted to go because Robbie said, yo, bro, let's make this dope as possible. And I'm like, I know how to do it, but it's just going to be really expensive. He's like, well, if there's anything that you could do to help, you know, like use your account to buy this, you know, this and that, like if there's any workarounds, cool. But if not, if that's the price, then let's just do it. And it was an expensive package. It was probably like 30 grand for everything. Those ITBs were probably almost 20,000 bucks. So there wasn't really, I didn't really see a market because I didn't want to do anything that was just like surface level 911. I wanted it to be like badass 911. Everything that I put on Civics, I wanted to do on the 911s, to be honest. But the 911s just cost a little bit more because like those ITBs are a work of art. And then now I feel like guys like BBI, and I have some like private label customers that are doing 911 stuff. CMO at SV Auto, guys that are just like in the Orange County, LA area, they're like the top notch builders, and I'm doing stuff with them. And I think now I could just probably, I think I'm going to do a harness. It's actually going to come out really soon. That's going to be a motorsport ECU. So MoTeC M1, you know, like M-tron, like the good ECUs, it'll be compatible with. And because they're all the same connectors, so they all pretty much do the same thing. So one harness is going to be able to easily be anything kind of deal. And then, yeah, I think that a proper motorsport with the dual drive-by-wire on the 911 is really like the deal maker when it comes to properly. Like that's what all these guys that are doing EFI conversions on classic 911s, it's coil on plug using proper like ID injectors. And then that dual electronic throttle body is 100% the way to go.
I've seen them done before, and I feel like you're the perfect guy who should have one, a Porsche with a K-Series swap. It's kind of like the best of both worlds for you.
We've done a bunch of them, yeah. Me physically not doing the work, but wiring with customers, right. We've done a bunch.
That's cool.
Yeah,
I see one
cool.
In your stable.
I'm weird with Porsches, man. I kind of like them pretty simple.
You're like a purist.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah, very weird.
Super
compared
weird.
To, right.
Compared to your CRX with a B16.
Yeah.
The Frankensteins
and
of
then
your Honda
builds. The other Hondas that we haven't talked about yet, right?
Yeah, yeah. So.
My favorite Honda of yours is your EA, which I think is a work of art. But So, you mentioned that before. And this is a hot topic for you now because you just debuted at SEMA,
right?
A Tesla swap, but you have two.
I do.
The EG and the EK.
Well, technically I have three because I have the S2000 as well.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Remember. Yeah. That was actually your first,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I don't, and that's definitely something that's like absolutely psychotic. If I like actually think back about on it, that I have three Hondas that have electric drive units when I myself have only seen like four or five ever in the entire world, and I built three of them. It's pretty weird, but
other ones in Thailand.
Yeah, there's a Civic in Thailand, yeah. And then I actually did see an S2000 with an EV drive unit in it before.
Oh wow!
Yeah, and then there's like a couple like old classic Hondas that have been electric converted.
So three of five, we're actually talking with the leader, if not pioneer, of EVs in Hondas.
I guess. Well, percentage wise, definitely right. If
right.
I have three of them, there's only five that I can think of. So.
Let's jump to the quick question.
Sure.
How much is it to Tesla swap a Honda, a golden era Honda?
That's a loaded question. The cost effective way to do it is to definitely use battery modules, right? You pay per kilowatt hour. So you have to, if you're trying to save money, you're going to get a small battery pack, right? And then you're going to use a used motor, and the motors that are quote unquote like hackable, or, you know, you can take out the inverter logic board and put a Cascadia/AEM one in it, is going to be the Tesla Model S stuff. So you use a Tesla Model S. Those motors are like $1,000 to $4,000, just depending on where you source it and which one you use. And then batteries, like I said, you pay per kilowatt hour. So a really small battery pack that's like 16 kilowatts, like my EG, is probably about $2,500. And then a big, this is all used. And then a big battery pack like my EK, 85 kilowatts, $16,000 to $20,000 used.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I mean,
just in parts, you're at about 20 to 30 grand.
Yeah. And then the electronics, like all the AEM electronics are kind of figured in. So yeah, 20 to 30. Like if you wanted to build my EG, which is a single motor, front motor only, very small battery pack, and you already have an EG and you already have, like, you know, suspension, wheels and all that, but you wanted to build that car, you'd probably be 25 to 30. And then my EK is a dual motor, so it's all-wheel drive, 300 horsepower per motor. They're the small drive units, 85 kilowatt pack. That car, we did a lot of fabrication. The whole floor is cut out. Half of the battery pack is structural. Half of the battery pack's in, like, boxes that are mounted. That's probably, like, a $60,000 deal.
And you're not factoring in labor.
Yeah, that's not labor or the car, really.
Yeah.
Well, some of that would be labor, because I actually had a fabricator do some floor structuring and stuff like that. So some of that would be fab labor and stuff like that. Kind of hard to say, because everybody has their own skills and, you know, talents. Like, my EK is wired like motorsport. You know, it's probably if I had to charge somebody to wire that car front to back with everything that I did, it's probably a $20,000 job. So, but then I don't do as much of the fab. I do a little bit of CAD stuff, but I don't do a lot of the welding and fabrication stuff. You know, you got to just figure out where you specialize, right? And then so that could be a wash. If you were pretty good at fab, but you aren't so good at wiring, maybe that would, like, those numbers would be the same. They would just be flip-flopped, you know?
So what made you want to do that, build an EV?
So I did my S2000 the first time to get my feet wet.
What year?
What year did I do it? I think I started in like 2019, and then it was done in like 20. Well, it was finished the year that there wasn't SEMA for COVID, because I wanted to try to have it in the Turn 14's indoor booth. And I think that was 2020 or 2021. Did they do a bye year? I don't know. I'm so bad with years. It just becomes mush when I get as old as I am now, I guess. But let's just call it 2020 that they didn't have it. So 2020 was supposed to be, or it got done in 2020. And then I should have done a Civic. Only reason I did an S2000 is because my buddy Alex from Belade Sports, the shop that was right next to mine, was like, here, have this chassis. Just because he has tons of cars and he gets wrecked ones. And so I just got a hammered shell and he gave it to me for nothing. And I was like, oh, maybe I should do an EV on this because I want to learn. But then in hindsight, I probably should have did the Civic first, because the Civic's a massive market. Whereas the S2K, good luck finding somebody that's going to, especially because the prices went up during COVID.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dude, I remember I have a beater S2K. You know, I say beater, but it's 220,000 miles. I just drive it every day. During COVID, I started getting thumbs up. And I was like, who are you thumbs upping? This car's Suzuka Blue, non-desired.
You've been driving it for 10, 15 years.
I've been driving it for 15 years and nobody cares. 10 years, nobody cares about it. You know what I mean? And then all of a sudden during COVID, it was sick ass car, bro. I'm looking through the window. Are you talking to me? when did this? And then I'm like, oh, it's because the prices are now they're 25,000. Yeah. Now they're 30,000. What's the premium one? Oh my God.
CR?
Yeah, CR, all of a sudden is selling for over 100K.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden, Now my S2K is like a collector's item.
Yeah.
And then that's when I did the EV conversion. So then I got all the...
You got bashed on.
How did you like destroy that pristine car? I'm like, this car was far from pristine. It was literally ready just to go to the junkyard.
Yeah.
It was a piece of junk.
That's interesting.
Ah, okay.
So Pioneer then, you're the first to do the EV in a Honda.
Yeah, I guess. But you know what though? Like the chassis is kind of like irrelevant, if that makes sense.
Right.
You know, I was inspired by BC because I do jobs for him and he's a friend of mine. And, you know, I do all of his wiring work. And then he was like, hey, I'm building these 911s and I'm going to try EV. And I'm like, that seems too easy. Like, I want to do like a parallel hybrid. I want it to be like crazy hybrid. He's like, it's pretty complicated. You should, you know, he's like, come over, help me with the wiring and I'll show you kind of where, like what I'm doing with this.
Right.
And I'm like, wow, this is pretty complicated. Like, I think I need to get my feet wet first here.
Interesting.
So
I was just going to ask, is it more complicated than a combustion engine wiring harness?
Wiring harness? No. I would say that what is more complicated is just like the programming, the CAN data that needs to send to all these different devices. So there's a way to build an EV and then there's a way to build it properly.
So we're talking about right now why it's hard to do a EV swap in Honda, right?
Why it's hard to do an EV swap in Honda. Yeah. So why it's hard to do a proper EV swap just in general, okay, is that there's a lot of CAN stuff. And if you're not a CAN engineer, which I'm not, I just like barely get by with it, to be honest. You have to first off, just wiring a CAN system is easy for me because that's what I do for a living. It makes solid sense. I totally understand it. But physically doing the programming, you have to think about all these different ways for devices, to turn on, for example, when the charger plugs in. And then, you know, or the key turns on when the driver requests it. You got to like start thinking about different things. And then you have to think about it as information has to be bouncing around to different devices on the CAN bus. So what the CAN bus is basically just a two-wire data stream. And there's hexadecimal codes, which are basically like numbers and letters that are formed making these really complex messages. So these little bits and bytes of information, like let's call it, just to keep it easy, engine coolant temperature, okay? So you want your ECT sensor on the side of your head on your gasoline engine to tell you what the water temp is, right? But you also want the ECU to know what the water temp is. You want the digital dash to know what the water temp is. Maybe you have other devices that like your radio, because it might also need to know what your water temp is, some random third-party gauge. So all these things will be connected to a CAN bus. That information will then be shared as a packet of a hexadecimal number that's always changing at different rates really quickly. And it's sharing that information to all those different units to basically cut down on wiring. So you have these two wires that are technically doubling up your now you have a water temperature wired to your ECU. You have it wired to your digital dash. You have it wired to all these different devices. Well, you don't have all those wires. You just have it wired once to an ECU or a VCU, a vehicle control unit, and it just spreads that information all over the car. So that's the way you have to be thinking when it's EV, because all these things that are like temperature thermistors, battery voltages, they need to be shared on all these different devices. Current values, discharge and recharge currents and stuff like that all need to be in multiple different places. So setting up all that data and doing all that programming is really like the hard part. That's way harder than like physically building an electric motor or wrapping your head around it. Gas engines, in my opinion, are more difficult. They got more moving parts, but there's a lot of similarities. They both use very complex water cooling. You know, like cooling on an EV is massively, my cooling system on my EK is massively complicated. I have valves and things, and I have one radiator that acts as like three different radiators. I use air conditioning to basically use my Freon to cool my drive units and my batteries. I also heat my batteries all in the same system. It's wild.
as you're saying this, I see like the Matrix background of all the crazy digits and right. numerics running behind you as you're talking.
And as I'm talking, I'm trying to figure out how I can like say all this information to you without it like sounding like I'm just
blabbing about yeah. numbers.
And it's hard for me to like
not... Are you telling us the truth or are you just feeding us whatever right now? Because you're like, they're not going to comprehend this.
No, I definitely... I can get
Elon Musk would have a great conversation together.
I'm sure he's way smarter than I am. I'm not that smart. I just like... I'm not scared to just try things and just like let myself organically learn it.
I don't get how you don't like puzzles.
I know. They're so frustrating. I hate them, dude.
Now we know what to get him for Christmas.
Yeah.
He doesn't like puzzles, yeah. but he'll figure out how to put an EV swap.
I think
you'll
like it if it's like a Honda puzzle, a picture of an EA. That
at the Honda Collection Museum in Japan,
yeah.
I bought the Honda puzzle and I finally put it together. Me and my wife put it together. And I don't know where it is now. It's probably under something stacked away somewhere in the garage or something like that. But
that is awesome.
Note to self, we'll get Ryan some puzzles.
Yeah.
Get him frustrated.
Eat, sleep, race puzzles.
So what is the future of Rawire?
I think that the future is to just continue doing private label stuff because that is really important to have a profitable business. I see it as doing things once is just not, it's not a good use of time. If you could do something really difficult, but then know that you're going to be able to do it 10 or 100 or 1,000 more times, I think that's the way to like continue and make it profitable and not lose interest or just lose your business because you don't have enough money to pay for it. I think so, more of that. And then also I think EV is interesting. I know that that's like a very difficult subject with people always wanting to go to it being something political. For me, it's nothing political. I'm not a tree hugger California guy, even though my parents are really like super hippies. I just really...
They're probably very proud of you.
I think so, yeah. I think they're proud of me, yeah.
Well, in terms of... Good job putting those Tesla motors in there.
Nah, they don't care about that.
Oh no.
My dad goes, how fast does it go? He doesn't like care that I don't think they even really have a grasp that I'm like recycling parts or something like that.
Maybe just because of the cost now, you know, that's not in the foreseeable short term future of how to grow your business.
Yeah.
But maybe as parts get cheaper, like I remember one of the parts you said would cost $20,000 right now.
Yeah, but that's also something that you to get the kit just to like work. Like that's why my white Civic, my EG, is gonna be like if I'm gonna try to put together a kit for people, it's gonna be based around my EG because that battery pack is only $2,500. Yeah, you get like way less range. Like it's literally like 75 miles versus like 380. Like that's a big difference.
Wow.
Yeah.
But you pay per kilowatt, man. So it's like, what do you want, right? Also it's difficult because each kit that these, you know, EVs, if you will, kits, you have to build a mount kit for every different chassis. Like I've had a lot of people ask about CRXs. Hey, when are you going to do a Miata? When are you going to do a CRX? When are you going to do an RX-7? When are you going to do this, that? It's like each one of those is different applications. They have different opportunities for fitment with batteries. I don't want to have you cut your whole floor apart. Like my EK is straight cut. Like it's Swiss cheese, that car.
Oh wow.
And it's put back together and it's strong because it's braced and it's, you know, but it's heavy. It's that car is the heaviest EK in the world, like probably for sure. 3,375 pounds, but my EG is only 2,200 pounds. 22. I was really surprised with how light that is.
Wow. It's all battery.
Yeah, because you have like when I say kilowatts, that's weight too. Yeah. 85, 16. Big difference.
So do you see different markets as a big way for you to expand as well? Or is that just part of the white label? Whatever manufacturer or whatever platform needs you to white label is where the growth is.
Yeah, I think so. Because I'm not going to go like, oh, I don't want to do this kind of car because like I don't care.
Right.
You know? It's exciting to see people that are enthusiastic about cars just in general. They don't necessarily have to be Honda guys or they don't have to be any sort of thing. Like it is what it is. I'm glad to see everybody like if they can make their brand something by using my parts and more power to them.
I like to ask you this question because as more cars get modified, or as cars are modified, your product is in demand. In this era that we're in 2024, where do you see our current, I guess, the economy of scale of modifying cars? Are we in a growth stage? Are we plateaued? Where do we stand in your eyes?
Well, I think, like, just step back a little bit. Before COVID, I felt like a lot of people were kind of losing enthusiasm with cars. But then during COVID, it like ramped right back up. So I'm sure that there's going to be some ups and downs. But I think that like nature is always going to, you know, like there's going to be the desire to modify things. So even if it's not, you know, a 12-cylinder swapped, whatever, you know, this kind of car, there's still going to be a huge market for enthusiasts in the automotive industry. And that could be EV, it could be some alternate, it could be some hydro powered, whatever, like, I don't know. We'll see. But that's the thing. People got to stay enthusiastic and new and really cool technologies and things that we've never even really thought about could pop up. Like, wow, we used to hate that. But now if we do this one little thing or make that motor, engine, whatever, propeller run on this different kind of gas or fluid or whatever color, I don't know. You know what I mean? It could run off of a color. It could run off of air. It could run off of who knows what. But people have to be enthusiastic enough about it to make that Thomas Edison light bulb, you know?
Right.
Let's figure out what else is possible. So I think that there's a lot of opportunity. I think that it's going to stay something that people are going to want to.
I'm glad you bring it in that manner, because here at the PRI trade show, it's very relevant, because as we walk the show, you know, you see a lot of new things popping up, like especially in manufacturing, for example. I saw a lot of 3D printer
exhibitors. Yeah.
That's not something we saw 4 or 5 years ago.
No.
And I'm actually like looking at it like, this is pretty sick. Like,
oh yeah.
In terms of just R&D and even bulk manufacturing, like that wasn't a thing. So like you said, even though with the evolution of where we are in the industry as a whole and innovation, there's just going to be new companies, new trends, new ways to modify things. That desire to modify will live on generations beyond us.
Yeah, they're printing metal now too, you know? So it's like not just like 3D carbon plastics.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're doing carbon fiber, but they're also doing like literally like Inconel and like, you know, different forms of metal are actually getting printed. There are 3D.
I wonder if that's down there. I haven't seen that. I don't think I saw that.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know, but I know it's definitely a thing.
Wow.
I know they're 3D printing concrete houses. So, yeah,
I've seen that.
Dude,
yeah.
It's wild. So I would have never even thought of that.
On my way here, there was one booth that had an oversized printer, maybe 4 or 5 feet tall,
mm-hmm.
and it was printing massive units. I was like, I didn't know that existed.
Wild.
Yeah.
Like full bumpers or something like that, right?
Literally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wild. That's cool.
Yeah, I saw that on Instagram. This guy made a bumper, 3D printed a bumper.
Yep.
It looked heavy. Like the way he's carrying it, it looked heavy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, maybe he didn't break out all the structure or something yet.
Yeah. But... It was in raw form.
Yep.
But that's just crazy. Yeah, you know, a lot of people just get mesmerized when you're walking down Machine Alley and you see these aluminum blocks getting shaped into like a cylinder head or something like that.
Yeah.
Now you're just, you could 3D print that out. I mean, obviously not use it, but maybe use it for R&D or something to kind of, to obviously, you know, make things more innovative.
Yeah. And then there's companies doing like brand new, like 2JZ casted blocks and, you know, like, oh man, there's only a finite amount of these engines left. And then, well, now there's all of a sudden there's as many as you want because they're actually doing cast and not just billet, you know, not just full like CNC'd parts, but actually casted parts, which is pretty cool too.
Do you see AI affecting your business?
I mean, I know so little about AI that's the thing. I can't even like comprehend how or why it would even like affect me at all until it's too late, probably. Or you know what I mean? Or until I come up with an idea that's like, oh wow, that's exactly what AI would be for.
I could use it, right?
Yeah, but right now I'm completely like lost.
Haven't found any use for AI in what you're doing yet.
Nothing.
Yeah, I wouldn't ChatGPT how to make a wiring harness. I just
your mind might be blown.
But if you really think outside the box, there could be something totally possible with AI. But I never even thought of it. I have no idea.
Honestly, we know very little about it too, but like our minds have been blown. No, but I would want to say, like, even in our line of business, we're apparel and accessories. You would never even think, what's AI going to do for them? We use it pretty often.
Yeah.
To the point in which, like, yeah, it's a lot of things, like, never even knew we could use that. I feel like the, I would actually give this advice to a lot of kids in college right now. Like, I feel that the greatest advantage that you can have in going to school or just learning things in general is how can you apply AI to what you're doing? Because he who knows how to use the AI will be in more demand than knowing how to actually solve that problem.
Sure.
So like you just said, I'd rather do something once and it be able to be replicated 500, 1,000 times.
Interesting.
So in terms of AI, right? If you know how to do something that AI can, there's something AI out there that can be utilized.
Yeah.
I'd much rather hire you than 100 people that it would have normally taken me.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's what we're seeing right now. And even like, what were we just saying yesterday? Like, and we were at a restaurant. We're like, look, AI took that over. Was it folding napkins or something? But it's like, why do you need 20 people to do the dishes when...
No. What was that?
I think that was a TikTok that I was watching.
Yeah.
Well, we definitely brought up AI at dinner yesterday, but it was that same conversation. Like, I didn't even know it could do that.
Yeah, that's the thing. I guess I can't think outside of the box enough at this moment.
Yeah, the power and intelligence is knowing how can I find the use for AI.
The AI also involves robots, right?
Like
the Tesla.
Sure.
So like you could buy a Tesla robot and say, hey, make these harnesses for me, right?
Potentially.
And this robot is doing this.
Because you said you made one.
Yeah. If I do one and then I let the robot cop or just literally watch me do it.
And this robot's making your wires over there. And
I'd love to play this video back in the
Can I get this robot on Temu? Is that what you're saying? Can I get that on Temu?
Not quite yet. I mean,
soon.
Yeah, because Tesla started it. We got to wait for Temu to copy it. Right?
Once the podcast gets on the internet and the internet picks it up,
the AI picks it up.
The AI will read it, and then therefore you'll see it. So a couple months.
A couple months.
We got to get the podcast out.
I'll hold you to it,
And then we will wait in a year for the robot to come out, and we'll wait for another year for one to be working at RyWire.
Yeah, remember I said I had 4 employees? Now I just have like 7 robots.
Yeah. Or one robot.
Yeah.
Because you don't need 7.
Yeah, I'm on some island somewhere.
Yeah. Remote.
Yeah.
I like it. Hey, with that being said, we appreciate you taking the time. This was a long conversation that's been a long time coming because I think 2 years ago is when we started the podcast now.
Yeah.
And I already had it in the back of my head, like, Al Rye is one of the guests I want to get on.
Yeah. And we like to do them live. Like, it's cool to do the remote.
Virtuals.
Yeah. But we had to run into each other, so.
Yeah. And,
perfect.
You know, we always do. It's just the right timing and happened.
Yeah, thanks for having all the equipment. It worked out awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks
for
guys.
Thanks to our guys behind the scenes, Harry and Nick.
Thank you.
All right. Till next time. Appreciate you guys. If you like this episode, make sure you like, comment, and subscribe. Eat, Sleep, Raise podcast. Till the next one. Oh, and even better, if you want to follow Ryan, shout out your socials.
RyWire _motorsport on IG. And that's pretty much the only place I post.
Not a Facebook guy?
Nah, not really.
Not a TikTok guy?
I think it's just RyWire on Facebook.
He's like, I don't even know my page.
I have a YouTube channel here and there, but I normally just like make appearances on other people's YouTube, so.
All right, till next one.